This is episode 420, dated Friday, July 11th, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. Great to be here with all of you today. This is episode 420. Dated Friday, July 11th, 2025. Before we continue, allow me to introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, welcome back. How are you?
I'm in Dallas, Texas right now. I'll be leaving tomorrow home from the ACB convention. Here it's, you know, miserable weather, of course, being Texas in the summer. 92 degrees, lots of sun, lots of humidity. I can't wait to get back to Coos Bay tomorrow when it's like 65, lots of sun and breeze.
We are partly sunny today. We're about 80 or a couple of degrees either way. And we've had off and on showers. It's typical summer weather, humid, tropical weather from time to time. Before we continue, allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with our editor and producer, Raymond Gay. Thank you very much for what you do. Along with our media outlets, thank you for airing us when you do. It is much appreciated. Also, we cannot forget Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, who archives our shows on my website. If you want to check out the archives, just go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them and you will catch most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
And let me also acknowledge Trish, our facilitator for today's program, along with Herbie, our streamer. And because we are live streamed at the moment, I think it's important that we give out our email address because we want people who listen to our show to comment on it, to tell us what they think, because we do this for the listener. It's all about the listener and what they enjoy listening to. So my email address is bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. Many of you listen to talk radio, I'm sure. A lot of you are from the New England area. And you may remember back in the good old days of the 80s and 90s, I think. I know the 80s for sure. There was a talk show host in Boston by the name of Ken Meyer. He's a blind talk show host. Well, Ken is on our program today to talk about the old days. He might even talk a little bit about Red Sox. That would be nice because he and I share the same compassion and passion for that team. But Ken is here to talk about what it was like being a talk show host and how he went about that. Ken, welcome to In Perspective.
Well, welcome thank back. You. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you with us. So we're talking 1980s. Am I correct when you first came on the scene on W?
No, actually it was earlier than that. I started at BZ in 1971.
1971. See, I only heard about you around 1980 when you were doing overnights. I think that was on BZ as well at the time.
It was, and then in 1986, I went to WEEI and hosted Radio Classics for 4 or 5 years.
And that was before WEEI became all sports all the time.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure a lot of blind people especially would love to be talk show hosts, and of course you were successful at it. So, what gave you the idea of becoming a talk show host, and what kind of assistance did you get because of the fact that you would be a blind talk show host? I think a lot of people would like to know in case they want to follow in your footsteps.
Well, I had always wanted to do air work. I wasn't exactly sure what it would be, but I always wanted to do it. And through a series of happenstance circumstances, I wound up at BZ and started as a producer for Larry Glick. Keep in mind, they didn't have computers back then. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have the ADA. So, but I did get assistance as far as you know, BZ bought me a Braille writer. I had a tape recorder, and that was it. That was how I managed to function when the show was on the air.
And what did you do with, what did being a producer mean back then with Larry?
It meant trying to set up calls ahead of time before the show went on the air, or if we found an interesting call during the broadcast, to make the call off the air and obtain the person's permission to put them on the air. Because before that, Glick was on the air all by himself. It was him and an engineer. So if somebody called up Larry and said, Larry, I've got the number for Alf Landon, the ex-vice president. Here it is. And of course, they took the number off the air, but Larry would make the call and you would hear the call go through. You'd hear the phone ring. You'd hear the person pick up the phone. Hi, this is Larry Glick. We're on the air now on station WBZ in Boston. And somebody didn't like it and threatened to sue the radio station because they felt that their privacy had been threatened. So that was then that they decided that they needed a producer. And I had come along looking for a job, and they decided to hire me and give me a chance to do it. And as a result of that,
talk about that hiring process. What do you think prompted them to hire you? As you know, blind people are not known for being hired easily. What do you think prompted them to hire you?
Boy, that's a long story. My parents and I came to Boston, where I had gone to college, and got together with one of my instructors, who was an engineer also at WEEI at the time. And we got together with the president of the college, a gentleman named Milton Graham. And there was a man named Lamont Thompson who was on the board of trustees at Graham and also worked at WBZ Radio. So they contacted Thompson, and Thompson agreed to set up an interview. And I went to BZ and talked with him for about half an hour. And he said, is there anyone you would like to meet? And I said, yeah, I would like to meet Guy Manila, who at that time was hosting Calling All Sports. Those were the days when a sports show was only 2 hours long, if you can believe that. So I went down, had a nice chat with Guy Manila, and he said, would you like to meet our program director? And I said, sure, I'd love to. So he took me across the hall and introduced me to a guy named Bill Schubert. And it turned out that Bill Schubert and my instructor, Dick Walsh from Graham, used to work together at WEEI. So Schubert picked up the phone, called the school, and talked to Dick Walsh for a good half hour. And he put down the phone and said, Kenny, if you can do half the stuff he says you can, I'd hire you tomorrow. But we don't have any room in our budget. So I said, okay, suppose I get the state of New York to pay my salary for X number of months. And then we go from there. If I can do everything right and BZ can hire me, I'm there. If they can't, I can still walk out the door and say I had six months experience at a major radio station. And that's exactly what happened. I worked there for 6 months. BZ found out I could do the job. Glick needed a producer. And as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest is history.
So talk more about that history. Again, what did you do as a producer? Say, talk a little more detail. I know you sort of, I gather you sort of scheduled guests and made sure guests were available and all that stuff.
Yeah, that was a lot of it. And part of it was if during the program, somebody called up with a call that Larry deemed interesting, they would give me the phone number off the air. I would take down the number and I would call the person and say, you know, hi, this is WBZ Radio, et cetera, et cetera. We heard about you and your whatever it was that you do or have. and Larry Glick, who is our talk show host, would love to interview you. Would you agree to that? And they would say yes, and we'd put them on the air. I did that for 7 years, along with working some shows with Jerry Williams at BZ and Calling All Sports from time to time, and then eventually getting on the air at BZ, doing fill-in work, and also having a show on Saturday nights.
So talk about some of the folks you interacted with as a producer. Who were some of the most famous or interesting people you talked with?
Well, let's see. There was Tony Conigliaro. There was Bob Newhart. Oh, boy. Jesus, it's been so long.
That's all right.
We, one of the people that became one of the regulars, there was a caller that gave us a call about a restaurant in Las Vegas named Batista's Hole in the Wall Restaurant. And so this guy, Batista, was a singing chef. He would sing to the audience in the restaurant. So we called him and we put him on the air and he was great. And it turned out that the night that we called, Jack Williams was there because Jack was working in Las Vegas and was going to come to Boston to work at WBZ-TV.
With Tony Pepper.
With Tony Pepper, right. So we put Jack on the air with Larry, and he took calls in the restaurant for, about an hour or so. And we had a lot of fun. We had Minnesota Fats, the pool player, on the program one night. There was a book that was written once called The Ghost of Flight 401. And it was a story about an Eastern airliner plane that crashed in the Everglades in Florida. And I heard about this on another radio station in the morning when I woke up after my morning nap and said, hey, this is going to be perfect for Glick. So I got in touch with the publishing people and they sent me a copy of the book, and the author's name on the author was John Fuller. And I called Fuller and talked to him, and he said, now Glick's not one of these guys that's just going to read the book jacket and let it go at that, is he? And I said, oh no, not Larry. He's going to read this book from cover to cover. So I gave the book to Larry and I said, Larry, you've got to read this book. And he said, why? And I said, cause I told the author that you would. So he did. And Larry, had a good interview. We had, who else? We had Milton Berle, which we had to tape in advance because he wouldn't stay up at 1 o'clock in the morning. We had Lowell Thomas. We had Tom Snyder when the Tomorrow Show was just getting started and they wanted publicity. We had William Peter Blatty, who wrote the book The Exorcist. And that's an interesting story as well.
Is that what the movie's based on?
That's what the movie's based on. The book was really hot at the time. And we were able to get Blatty. Blatty agreed to do an interview, and Larry said, geez, I'll never be able to read the book in time. So I said, well, Larry, I've got the book on Talking Book Records. I'll give it to you. You listen to it over the weekend, and you'll get the book ready. And we did. And Larry was so impressed with the guy who read it, whose name was Leon Janney, for any of you that go back that far. We decided to do a conference call with Janney and Peter Blatty that night on the phone, and we did. It was one of the more successful things that we were able to do on the air. So those were some of the things that, we were able to do with Larry and have a lot of fun with.
So I presume from what you said that Larry's primary hours are like, 12 a.m. to 6 a.m. or something like that?
Yep. That was about it. When I started with him, that's what it was.
When I first listened to it, it was 8 to midnight.
Yeah, that's when they changed it. Biggest mistake they ever made. Yeah, they put Larry on 8 to midnight, and Larry he liked it because it was better hours. The audience didn't like it because there were people at that time, BZ hit 38 states in Canada, but at those hours, they didn't reach as far at 8 o'clock at night. And all we would get were young people calling up saying, hey, Larry, can you play such and such? Or Larry, can you do so and so? And Larry didn't care for that. He liked more of the kooky audience, which came on after midnight or around 10, 11 o'clock at night. So it was rough for quite a while. And then they changed it from 10 at night till 2 in the morning, which worked better for Larry. And, you know, he got his kind of calls. After he left BZ, he went to WHDH and was on at 10 o'clock in the morning. And that didn't work.
Larry, less of an audience.
Larry's whole shtick was better at night. BZ had even tried putting him on in the afternoon, if any of you remembers that, like at 1 to 5 in the afternoon. And the one thing they found out was never put Larry Glick on the air when there's a snowstorm and cancellations to be read.
Oh no.
Cause Larry, you know, if a training school for dogs was canceled, needless to say what Larry Glick did on the air. But he was a lot of fun. He was an icon. He had started out at WMEX and came to BZ, recommended by Jerry Williams, as a matter of fact, and was very successful. After he left WHDH, he retired and moved to Florida and was a greeter for many years at Legal Seafood.
He regarded his audience as Glicknicks.
Yep, exactly. They had University Glick t-shirts. There was a record album, which was put out with some of his more interesting phone calls called Let Me Check, and which I have a copy of, as a matter of fact.
Let Me Check.
Yeah. And he was a unique talent. There was nobody like him.
So what distinguishes a sort of a good talk show host, you know, late night, early morning, from a talk show host who does his work during the day, normal hours?
Well, I don't know. Maybe
or
just
I guess what maybe what made Larry so successful as a late night, early morning talk show host?
Because he didn't talk politics. Late night was the time for people to relax and unwind and just enjoy the late evening and have a good time and, you know, just shoot the breeze and not talk about presidents and things that were going on in the Middle East and things like that. Although there were times when if there was something happening over in Israel, we had a correspondent over there named Jay Bushinsky, who worked for Westinghouse. Westinghouse had an outfit over there, and Larry would call there once in a while. But it was just the idea of being able to relax and enjoy yourself after a long, hard day.
Did you, are you aware of Art Bell at all?
Yes.
Ms. Corning, do you think Art Bell, who I know is a late night fixture, and were the two similar, Art and Larry?
Well, from what I can recall, he kind of liked the same thing that Larry did. They were both interested in UFOs and things like that. That's the kind of, Larry loved that stuff. And Bell did too, from what I can remember.
I understand he did, yep.
And he was good at it. He was good at it. He would have somebody on the air, for example, who took a tape recorder to a cemetery and claimed that he recorded voices of the dead from the grave in a cemetery with a tape recorder. And that's, I mean, boy, I can picture Larry drooling over a subject like that. But that's what made, you know, late night talk radio successful. I don't even listen to talk radio anymore at night or television. But it was a different time, and it was just, you know, a great time to be around and be alive and be part of it.
Now, what about your own show. Let's talk about that for a little while. You had a show. I used to listen to it from time to time. It was overnight, if I remember correctly.
Right.
And yep. What was your theme? What did you decide to do with it?
They let me do whatever I wanted. They didn't care. I could interview sports people. I could interview comics. I could do whatever I wanted. And I did. I interviewed a man named Frank Thomas, who was not the ball player, but who was Tom Corbett, space cadet. I interviewed Ken Smith, who was the director at the time of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Oh, gosh.
Tony Conigliaro?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't do him. Larry did, because he was going to build a Holiday Inn over in Israel. Oh. So Larry interviewed him. Sometimes if we had a good guest on the Glick Show, I would have them on my program as well. I interviewed John Fuller after Larry did on the Ghost of Flight 401. I interviewed the Lennon sisters from the Lawrence Welk Show. Mm. I interviewed Connie Francis. Oh boy. That's some of the people I can think of off the top of my head. But it was a lot of fun. They didn't care what I did. And it was great. I mean, listen, a station like BZ with 50,000 red hot watts at that time with no internet, man, you get calls from all over. I remember one day the station called me in and said, listen, we got a tape here of somebody calling BZ, but we can't figure out who the talk show host was. And the talk show host was me. Somebody had recorded my program from Greece.
Oh, wow.
And sent it to BZ. And so, you know, I got a chance to hear what I sounded like from Greece. And
how did they hear you in Greece?
Just the skip of the radio wave, I guess. I don't think it works that way anymore, but you know, that's something you don't forget.
I wonder why it wouldn't work that way anymore. The conditions, have the atmospheric conditions changed since then?
Not that I know of, but I really don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I think the issue is that the atmospheric conditions are the same, but the way they broadcast and the way they do their thing is different. It's a whole different model.
Yeah, everything is different. I mean, the internet now, I mean, man, you can get called, people call in from San Francisco and, you know, all over California and even Texas.
All over the world.
All over the world. Yeah. It's in a way, it's fascinating to hear, you know, where the calls come from. So, but I don't listen to talk radio as much anymore, mostly because more sports is available now and I like to listen to that.
The only thing with 24/7 sports, and I've said this, Peter knows how I feel. I've written about this. The thing about 24/7 sports, which is what WEEI in Boston is now, it tends to get watered down to the point where there's a lot more gossip on sports programs now than ever before. Because you referred to Guy Mamilla. That was a classic example, talking about Guy Mamilla's calling all sports. Yep. You listen to solid sports for 2 hours, they get right to the point, and you can't wait till the next show the next day or the next weekend or whenever. Nowadays, it's all watered down because it's 168 hours a week.
Yep, and the Sports Hub does the same thing.
It's like a soap opera almost now.
Yeah, the only thing I listen to is the Baseball Hour with Tony Maserati at 6 at night. I don't listen to talk shows anymore during the day because I just don't. I used to. I used to listen to EEI when they would have Larry Lucchino when he was with the Red Sox. And if I knew that there was going to be a special guest that I wanted to hear, I would take time and listen to him. But again, you're right. It's watered down. It's not the same. I don't listen to it.
So I'm curious about, we were talking about how you did what you did as a producer. What kind of accommodations? How did you do your, when you were hosting? What was that? What was that kind of like?
Well, I always would set up my own calls. I didn't have a producer do it for me. I did it. If there was somebody I wanted, Like, for example, one of the people that I had was a guy named Gil Fates, who was the producer for What's My Line, the television show. I got home one night after work, turned on Johnny Carson, and saw this guy and said, hey, I'm going to get him. And I called the publishing people. They sent me the book. They told me how to get in touch with Fates. I did. And my producer put him on the air, and that was how we got guests. Simple as that. There was nothing, you know, nothing complicated. It was a lot easier doing it back then than it is now.
You had an engineer, correct?
I had an engineer and a producer.
So what did the engineer and the producer, how did the engineer and producer support you?
The engineer made sure we stayed on the air. The producer would put calls through, and when we would take calls, he would screen the calls ahead of time. For example, if we had a guest on the air, like a Gil Fates talking about What's My Line, and we decided to take telephone calls, he would hopefully make sure that nobody would call wanting to talk about UFOs or something completely off what we were doing. And that's what producers used to do over there as well. And now
you had a 7-second sort of thing if people used vulgar language or something.
Yep. We had a 12. Well, first it was 12, then they cut it down to 7. but now it's different. They don't have engineers at BZ anymore. They just have producers who have to make sure that the station stays on the air, and it's a lot harder than it was before.
Of course, now iHeart took over WBZ, and you don't hardly find the talk host on BZ anymore except for Dan Ray and
Morgan White.
And Morgan White and maybe a couple of fill-ins, but it's all news most of the day and most of the overnight now. It's a lot different. And you're talking about the 7-second delay. I've heard some things on the air lately that I would never repeat on this program, but I remember somebody using the Lord's name in vain on the air one time, and I'm like, where's the engineer? How come this is allowed today? What happened?
Well, they do that these days. I've had this discussion with Upton Bell before about how the landscape has changed and what they allow on the air now, and that they wouldn't have allowed way back when. And I don't listen to it, so I don't hear what you've heard, but I wouldn't like it. It's not the place for it. And there's nothing I can do about it, unfortunately. And that's just the way that talk radio is going these days.
Well, it just makes us wonder what's happening in the radio industry today. They don't seem to be as cautious about things like this as they once were.
Well, they go where the money is, right? So people seem to want more of that stuff.
I've had more and more people tell me that you wouldn't want to be in the business anymore because it's not the same and you wouldn't enjoy it as much. Now, I still do interviews once in a while, and I still enjoy it. I had an announcer named Ed Walker in Washington, D.C., who used to work with Willard Scott from the Today Show. And they used to do a program together called The Joy Boys. And Ed told me one day, he said, Kenny, if you love radio and it's in your blood, you'll never get out of it. And he was right. I mean, here I am at this age in my life, and I'm still involved in it, and he was right. Radio is in a lot of ways still very special. Not like it was, but you know, you got to take what you can get.
So how involved are you now? What are you doing in radio now? Where you're still involved in it?
When I can, I do a talk show, an internet show for the city of Boston on WBCA 102.9 FM. And it's on Saturday nights at 7 o'clock.
WBCA.
We've had local people like, well, Upton Bell, Bob Lobel, Susan Warnick, Ron Della Chiesa. A year or so ago, we reached a very high water mark and had Carol Burnett as a guest. And that was a real highlight.
He does the best Tarzan yell I've ever heard.
Yeah, exactly. You know, somebody asked me about guests earlier on the Glick that we had on the air. One of them was a guy you may have heard of too, named Bob Hope. We had him on the Glick show. I interviewed him a couple times, and that day, I mean, man, you know, there are thrills and there are thrills. And that was one. Lawrence Welk, I had a chance to interview Phil Harris, Don Wilson from the Jack Benny show, Dennis Day, people of that nature. And the audience just loved it and loved it.
How do you, or how did you handle the thrill factor? In other words, you've interviewed some fairly famous, well-respected people, the Bob Hopes, the newscasters, the sports folks. How do you deal with the fact that, you know, these people are pretty amazing and I have a chance to interview them? How do you prepare for something like that?
I loved it. You know, I'd get them on the air and I'd turn off the mic and say, wow, and then go back on and ask a serious question. You know, it's as simple as that. They are people. And I admit I was excited when I had the chance to do it. And I don't know really how else to answer that.
The reason I asked the question is the banquet speaker of the ACB last night was a guy who interviewed folks. And one of the folks he interviewed was Stevie Wonder. And he was talking about sort of how sort of he was tongue-tied almost. You know, here's Stevie Wonder, the, you know, the icon of music, not just he's blind, but, you know, just he's like the music guy from the 60s and 70s and 80s and maybe even 90s, who knows. And his producer said, it's okay to be in awe, you know, just go with it. And I thought that was sort of an interesting comment. And that's, I was curious sort of how you react to something like that.
Yeah. I mean, they knew it. I didn't hide my enthusiasm. Let's put it that way. But at the same time, I tried to do as much of a professional interview. Now, I admit, Carol Burnett, I was a little nervous. And my wife said to me, it's just Carol Burnett. I said, but she was great. It was once we got, I was a little nervous once we got started, but when we got going and then in the middle of the interview, she was great. And it was just like sitting down here talking to you.
What makes for a good interviewer and a good interview?
If you know your subject. I don't know how Larry King got away what he did for as long as he did. I mean, he never read books, neither did Larry Glick for that matter. But King never read books. He always admitted it. I tried my best to do that. If I was going to have an author on the air, I would send a book home and have my dad read it on cassette, send it back to me in Boston. I would play it and then go do the interview. Because I think when the people know that you prepared, I mean, they wrote the book and they like to think that if you're doing the interview, you thought enough of them to read it. I can remember.
That happens very often today. You know, sort of hearing some of the interviews I've heard over the years about, you know, authors. And it's certainly true for some of the folks who've interviewed me with my books. They clearly haven't read the book. And, and it's one thing if they say, I skimmed it or, you know, I've sort of, but it's another one they say they did read it when it's clearly that they did not read it.
Well, I could always tell when Larry never read a book because he would always open up the interview with, tell me a little bit about yourself and where you grew up, et cetera, et cetera. I was interviewing, well, I'll give you two examples. I was interviewing Eddie Fisher and we got into the studio late because of a mix up with another taping of a program. And we had to cut the interview down to half an hour and Fisher didn't want to leave. And his manager said, we got to go. You're scheduled to go to Toronto. And he said, yeah, but this guy actually read the book. You know, I don't want to go in the middle of an interview like that. And Connie Francis, I was interviewing her. And the same thing, in the middle of the interview, she said, how did you get this book right? And at that time, it had not been recorded. Well, my dad read it, Connie. Well, how long did it take? Et cetera, et cetera. And she was thrilled by that. And I remember there was a very, very dramatic moment in the interview when she talked about the fact of that she was raped at a Howard Johnson's hotel. And she said to me, she said, you know, I think I told this guy who I was. And I said to her, well, if you hadn't, do you think that you and I would be sitting here right now? And she said, no, I think he would have killed me. And, you know, there are things that will occur like that during, very unexpectedly, I might add, during interviews. You know, names are popping into my head. Frank Blair from the Today Show wrote a book. I love the title. Let's be frank. Let's be frank about it. And he confessed to being an alcoholic. And I had him on the air. And it was great. And I was in awe of it. But I tried not to show it too much because this is a guy that I watched and listened to on television every day, like millions of other people. And here I am being afforded an opportunity to talk to this guy, which not everybody can have. And I enjoyed every bit of it.
Are you aware if Frank Blair talked about his alcoholism with other people, other interviewers? Because he talked about it with you. Do you know if is this was sort of common knowledge, or did he talk about it with other interviewers?
Well, it was common knowledge because he wrote it in the book.
Okay, right.
Whether he talked about it with other interviews, I don't know. But I know he did. I always figured if it's in the book, you know, you're going to talk about it.
Sure.
Because I asked Eddie Fisher a question about Elizabeth Taylor, and he said he didn't want to talk about it. And I said, Eddie, it's in the book. So he talked about it. He talked about how he saved her life from committing suicide, as a matter of fact. And he didn't want to talk about it, but I said, look, you put it in the book, so let's talk about it. And he did.
As long as it's in the book, it's going to be public.
Exactly. Exactly. I always operated on that premise.
So I would like to turn our festivities over to our participants. We have people waiting to talk to you, I hope. So you're listening to In Perspective. Our guest is Ken Meyer, former talk show host in the Boston area over the years. And Trish, do we have anybody interested in asking Ken a question right now?
Yes, we do. Oh. We have Gene.
Gene.
So I don't really have a question, but Ken Meyer is Gene Man, and I just wanted to call and say hello.
Oh, Gene, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Ken and I went to the same school. He left before I got there, but we met each other many times at alumni reunions.
Yeah, how was alumni this year?
It was all right. It was small. I haven't gone in a while, and I went this year. It was a very small group, but it was all right. So, yes.
So where did you both go to school?
State School for the Blind and Batavia.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I went up to
Hey, that was good. It was almost like we rehearsed it.
Did you say Batavia?
Yes, did. We did.
They have a good wrestling program there. They did when I was at Perkins. Perkins used to have wrestling matches against Batavia many
times.
Yes,
we did. We had a very good wrestling program.
Yeah, we sure did. We had a good track team too.
Yep. We had two wrestlers. They were twin brothers, Murray and Mel Diamond. And,
gosh, yes.
Yeah, I know Murray won state championships and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah. I just wanted to say that I didn't grow up in Boston. I grew up in Buffalo, but I was visiting a friend in Boston one night during Christmas, I don't know when, and I don't remember if you were on the air or Larry Glick was, but I always remember the story because you were talking about this kind of stuff before, and it was some guy whose house was apparently haunted, and I don't know which one of you called him and was interviewing him, and he was talking about all the things that happened in that house, and of course that was in the days when nobody really believed in that stuff. But I remember laying in bed listening to that, and my friend and her mother and I were talking about it the next day because we were both awake and to hear it, and we decided neither one of us ever wanted to go to that house.
That brings back a memory of another guest we used to have on somebody called us about a couple in Monroe, Connecticut, named Ed and Lorraine Warren. I'm sure they're both probably deceased by now, but they were psychic investigators. And we had them on the air many times, and it always, always brought in calls.
They were involved with the Amityville house in Long Island, weren't they?
I believe they were, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe they were.
Yeah.
We also used to have on a guy named Frank Tallman, who was a Hollywood stunt pilot at one time in his career. So we, like I said, we had some great people at the time that we were doing the shows. So it's nice to hear from you, Gene.
You too, Ken. We'll see you someday, maybe.
I hope so.
Thanks for dropping in, Gene.
Okay, thanks a lot, you guys. Safe trip home, Peter.
Just keep paying those duties.
Gene?
I said safe trip home.
Yeah, thank you.
You're not home yet. Yeah, I paid my dues for like 10 years. I don't think I'm going to be paying anymore after that, so.
That's interesting.
Yeah, well, you never know. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, Gene.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Trish, do we have anybody else?
Yes, we actually have two hands. The next one is Musi, and then John will follow Musi.
Okay, Musi, you are next.
Okay, I have two questions. Was the person you interviewed physically in the room or on the phone or either or?
Most of the time they were on the phone.
Okay, that's what I
thought. We were very lucky sometimes to get people that would want to come in and do the show. One of the people that we had that I was very proud of to have in the studio, as a matter of fact, was a great Hollywood actor named Joe Campanella, who played in the Mannix TV show the first year when the agency was run by Intertech. Mm-hmm. And he was the boss. Mm-hmm. And he was also in a couple of Ironside shows and a couple of Quincy shows, and he was in the studio to promote, I don't even remember now what it was, but he agreed to come into the studio, and, well, you want to talk about being in awe? I'm sitting here with Lou Wickersham from Intertech.
Joe Campanella was also on a soap opera.
Okay. And my second question is, how's radio work these days? I thought it all went up to the satellite. I didn't think they had ground radio waves anymore. I thought it was all satellite.
Well, there's a lot of satellite involved in it. Some stations survive just on that. Mm-hmm. A lot of stations don't have people in the studio anymore. There was a friend of mine named Mike Adams who worked at 106.7 in Boston, WMJX, and he would do his morning show, and then for a couple of weeks, he did a show for a radio station in Detroit. They gave him all the information, all liner notes and everything by a computer. He'd sit in the studio in Boston, and it sounded like he was right there in Detroit. So that's the way radio's going these days.
Well, thank you so much. This is fascinating. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Musi.
Okay.
John?
Yeah, I'm here. Yes. Ken Meyer, it's a pleasure to be able to speak to you. I want to share that, I mean, I'm quite clear that in the late 70s, you did a Sunday night gig on WBOS 92.9, did you not?
No, sir.
No?
Oh, no, my God. That was Ken Mayer.
M-A-Y-E-R.
Has anybody ever confused the two of you?
Oh, yes.
Well,
yes.
Good. I'm in okay company, if not good company, but I was saying, oh my gosh. I mean, I'm sure I heard you as well, but I remember, 92.9 on Sunday evenings, I was at the Harvard Law from 77 to 80. And,
I used to listen to his program. I mean, he was from the old school. He was about as corny as you could get.
Yeah.
Give us a growl at 9698989.
Oh God.
You know?
Yeah.
And he, when he would do an ad for a restaurant, he'd read it right out of the paper. He didn't have copy. He just read it right out of the newspaper, and he would do 5 minutes of commercials for restaurants right in a row.
Yeah, it was kind of strange, but it was, you know, I mean, I would usually drift off to sleep listening to the radio. So on weekdays, it was Ken Westover on WEEI when it was a 590, you know.
Jim Westover, I remember him well.
Yeah, no, you see, he started at midnight. So, you know, that's kind of what I listened to. And of course, I mean, Boston radio must have changed a whole heck of a lot. I listened to WBZ. I find it interesting about somebody hearing it from Greece because, I mean, the fact of the matter is the laws of physics haven't changed, nor will they change. And medium wave frequencies which is where the AM broadcast band is. It just, I mean, you can always set up some super duper station with a, you know, 1 mile beverage antenna and, you know, just skip it. I'm never saying it can happen, but it's super, super rare. I mean, the reason why AM exists from 540 to, well, now 1700, the reason why it exists that way is because it does not support worldwide propagation. But that was very interesting about, you know, Greece. And of course, I listened to BZ some. I'm embarrassed to say I'm not sure that I heard you because I left Boston in June of 80 and only went back once.
John,
and yeah.
I'm curious about something because I was in Boston in 81 and 82 going to a graduate school.
Sweet. Oh, okay.
And, oh, I, yeah, 83. Yeah. 83 and 2, I was in Boston going to graduate school.
Right.
And I did most of my homework listening to Upton Bell primarily. Did you listen, when you did your work, when you had a chance, did you have the sports radio on in the background?
No, law is not the kind of thing where you want stuff in the background. It, you know.
Well, but people study differently, right? I mean, you.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Maybe it works for some, but.
Having, you know, sort of talk in the background helped me focus in a weird way.
No, I just want to talk when I drifted off to sleep. And
yeah, I understand. I was the same way.
But, no, no.
You know, I remember many nights working on my homework with Upton Bell berating at that time, the Patriots who were terrible back then.
Oh, Lord. No, legal reading being as dense as it is, that distraction I don't think would work for many people.
No, I understand.
It certainly didn't work for me if I trying to get the intricacies where every word is significant. That's the one thing between law school.
You know, I get it. That's why I didn't go to law school.
In grad school, undergrad, you broaden your mind. In law school, you hone it to a razor's edge or try to. But it's great to talk to you. And I'll stand down in case we have other folks.
I will say this, and Upton Bell said this to me, and he was so right. At the time we were at BZ, everybody that was there was a star. I mean, you had Gil Santos doing the Patriots. You had Bob Wilson, who, in my opinion, is the best hockey announcer that ever sat in front of a microphone.
I met him. He was at a Perkins Athletic Association banquet in 1973.
A better man you could not find. He was one of the best friends I ever had. I miss him to this day. And there'll never be anybody like him.
What about Johnny Most?
And
Johnny, same thing. Not as personable as a Bob Wilson, however. Not as personal. I mean, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Another hand raised?
Actually, we have two.
Oh, let's go ahead, Trish. Who do we have?
Okay. So the first is a phone number, 518-517. Can you unmute and let us know who you are?
Hi, my name is Mary Beth. And two quick things. While you were talking, I looked on Bard, and both the Ghost of Flight 401 and the Exorcist are still available.
Yes, they are. I've seen them.
I've just been talking in Braille. Yeah, but the Exorcist one is read by Mitzi Freelander, although I, too, am old enough to remember Leon Janney. I'm so glad to hear that this is going to be podcast because my friend Leslie Underwood was so sorry that she wasn't able to hear this. And she sends greetings to you, Ken.
Ah, I know Leslie very well. We grew up together.
Yeah.
We grew up together. We graduated from Batavia together.
Oh, I didn't know you were in the same cast. Well, she's going to be hunting down the podcast for sure.
Oh, good. Good. Tell her to give me a call.
I absolutely will. Thanks.
That's great.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Son of a man, never know who you're going to run into.
That's it, Ken. It's really interesting.
That's
all
amazing.
Right. Yeah. Who's next?
Okay, now we have Nora.
Nora, yes.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
Doing great. Nora from Phoenix, Arizona. And like 10, pleased to meet you. And what inspired you to get interested in doing radio talk shows in the past?
It's just one of those things you're born with. I was lucky enough to get in on whatever there was left of old time radio. And then I got friendly with an announcer in Rochester, New York, whom I owe more than I can ever repay, that helped me find Graham Junior College in Boston. And it just took off from there. I had a lot of mentors in my life. He was one. Dick Walsh from Graham College, the engineer, was another one. Bill Schubert, the guy who originally hired me at BC, was another one. In fact, I'm still friendly with his son to this day. So it was just a series of happenstance and circumstances and my love for radio. I always loved it and will to the end of my life. I'm a sports fan. That has never changed. My dad was a sports fan as well, and I got that from him, and that's just the way it went.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Great.
Thank you, Nora. Of course, Ken, you're thrilled the Red Sox have won 7 in a row.
Yes, I hope they can win 8.
Or 10 even.
Yeah.
After losing a bunch in a row, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Trish, do we have anybody else before we conclude? We have about 4 or 5 minutes, I believe, right? Something like that.
Yeah, we are clear at the moment.
So I have a question for you, Ken. How did your education at the School for the Blind and maybe college too prepare you for the work you did?
The education at the school really wasn't that, I don't want to say that valuable. I mean, I had to have it. The college was more productive because they had courses in radio broadcasting, how to run the radio equipment. Our school was not equipped for it. They knew what I wanted to do, but they couldn't help me much. They wanted me to do piano tuning. And I said, look.
So did they encourage you to do what you want to do? Or did they sort of say, nah, you got to do basket weaving or piano tuning or something?
I had a guidance counselor who was very encouraging and fought many battles with the vocational rehab service. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have been able to do what I did.
And talk about how you sort of made those connections in college that got you your first gig. How was it transferring from school for the blind to, you know, college where you might be the only blind person there?
Oh boy. Well, I mean, the connections were just there. I was the only blind person that was there, but I don't know. It just worked out. I mean, I just like any other student, and I did what I did.
So you left, you left talk radio when approximately?
1991.
Okay. So what have you been doing the last, 35 years or so?
Well, I've been working for the Disability Commission at City Hall in Boston and did a television show for the city. And retired in 2017 and still doing a part-time show for the internet for the city. And that's been about it.
We should talk about your work, at the, doing disability work in the 90s, but that's not the moment to do that now. I think we're running close to out of time, right, Bob?
Have about one more minute or so.
So I guess my last question for you is, what advice would you give to folks would like to follow in your footsteps to be a sports broadcaster?
I would say try and make connections somehow. I don't know how with people. Try and meet people if you can. Go to a school that specializes in broadcasting. I think there are still a few around. I think Boston University is one. Certainly Syracuse University is another one. When you have people there like Bob Costas, Sean McDonough, who are nationally known.
Yes, they are.
And they went to Syracuse.
One of the iconic radio media schools in the country.
Yep. So I would do that, essentially.
Well, I thank you for joining us. It's been a fast moving hour for me.
Yes, Ken, you know, very interesting discussion. Of course, as I said to you at the beginning, I remember you on a TV show in 84 when you were talking about the case where somebody was asked to remove, a blind person was asked to be removed from an exit row on an airplane. And you were on that panel on Channel 7.
Yeah. That was a long time ago.
Yeah. I remember that, 1984. But be that as it may, Ken, thanks for coming on the show and hopefully we'll have you back sometime and good luck with your internet show. I hope it continues to be successful. Sounds like a great opportunity.
I appreciate it. I thank everyone for participating as well as a few surprises.
Well, you never know who you're going to hear from on these shows, but thanks again. And thanks you to Peter and everybody else for helping us out today, as always. I'm Bob Branco. Go safe with God's abundant blessings, and talk soon. Take care.